Hello and welcome to episode 5 of Torquem Talk. Today we have on the owners from Clark Griffin Attorneys, Mike Clark and Philip Griffin. These guys are fun and we decided to do something a bit different. Instead of all of the attorneys telling you, call me when you're hurt, call me when you're hurt, an ambulance chase and everything like that, we talked for a few hours about how do you not get sued by these guys? What do you do as a business owner or as a person who drives a car, which is damn near all of you, how do you make sure you don't get sued? So we went in depth on that to bring as much value as we possibly can to you guys. So please enjoy this in-depth conversation between the three of us on how not to get sued in this country where everybody gets sued over anything. Let's just start. Here's something I like to start off with my own experience. So basically, we started Mazama in our house, and then we graduated to the broom closet, and then we graduated to a 2,000 square foot office, which was really cool. And we ended up getting like 10 or 12 employees, and we ended up, the average age was like 26, so we ended up having parties for, not all the time, just like Halloween, Christmas parties. Like we hosted our own instead of, because this business has always been started from bootstrap. There's no investors. The bank, we don't owe the banks any money. So we're like, well, let's save money instead of going to some expensive place and everything. We'll just get a keg and get some Little Caesar pizzas and have a fun time. And those were our most fun parties, honestly. Yeah. Flip cup happening. I mean, we're all young. It was basically like a college party. That was like 3-4 years ago. But then somebody, I forgot who, was just like, you could easily get sued if somebody drove home and got in a DUI. And we were really good at taking keys, but we had one team member who actually like stole his keys back, and he was pretty drunk. And then he like sprinted off the car, and he drove home. Luckily, he made it. But that could have been like, that could have been the end of the company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Easily. Like, not covered by any insurance, I don't think. Why would an office have that? And this could probably transcend into businesses that are like, that have, allow people to drink. Like we occasionally have a keg of beer here, not too often, but if somebody was a bit of an alcoholic and kind of abused, most businesses do like a one beer per day rule, maybe two, but how do you really enforce that? And have you guys ever heard of that? Like a company that got in trouble because they had a kegerator at the office, and then all of a sudden, somebody got in the DUI and they're on the hook?
You know, I haven't heard of any cases that have come out of something like that, but I would certainly imagine that there have been accidents that have occurred, and then that was the employer that ended up paying for that. Their insurance company, hopefully, or maybe just the employer just had to pay for it.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, as a business owner, you know your staff, you know your people, and you know what to watch out for. You know who's going to be stealing their keys. You know, hopefully.
Yeah, well, we did after that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. The next party, we made them take a taxi to and from.
Good. Yeah. And that, you know, it's, you know, unfortunately, a business owner is going to be responsible pretty much no matter what. If you overserved them, too bad. You're in trouble. And if you can,
or if he overserved himself or herself in this case,
right? If you allowed them to overserve themselves, sure. Yeah. And it doesn't matter if they violated some employee rule that they weren't supposed to overserve themselves. Too bad. You gave them the alcohol. You're going to be on the hook for it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, seeing if you have insurance that covers something like that, but it's probably very unlikely that you do. For not an event, but for just daily drinking on the job, probably no insurance for that. So I guess you got to just be really careful with what people are doing. And as the owner of the business, and you want to encourage that sort of atmosphere, that's great. That's the culture of the office or the business. But you've got to be real careful, because if one little accident happens and now everything is in turmoil, you're in trouble.
Yeah, once I learned that was a possibility, we now do all of our Christmas parties and all that sort of stuff at Deschutes, and the LCC like looks after it, and we don't even like to have alcohol here just because of like the thought of like it shutting us down is pretty terrifying.
Yeah.
But that's big value for business owners here, and I would like us to go deeper into this, because most you see lawyers of all the like, you know, if you're hurt, call us, we'll win the case, all sorts of stuff. It's done over and over again. I don't see any that are providing value on like, hey, on the other side of events, here's how you don't get sued. It's kind of counterintuitive when you think about it. Like, you guys are actually, like, let's dive into this and help business owners in the restaurant industry, offices.
Not use us.
Yes. Yeah, not use you.
We mentioned that as we drove over today.
Yeah. But,
you know, I think maybe just some legal background here is most of all of these cases arise out of the legal concept of negligence.
Okay.
And negligence puts a duty, the legal concept of negligence puts a duty on everybody in society to exercise their, whatever they're doing in the world, with reasonable care.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? They are termed to be a reasonable man, and if they violate that standard of reasonable care, a reasonable man, which is a little sexist, but
yeah,
that's how a person is found to be negligent. So, an employer, I mean, it's been said that you go to law school 3 years to learn the meaning of the word reasonable.
Reasonable? Really?
Yeah.
Three years.
As an employer, if you think about, are you being reasonable to intoxicate a person and send them out on the freeway at 11 o'clock at night? Just, that's the continual analysis that you have to be mm-hmm. doing. And certainly an employer, anybody who has assets, they're a target. I mean, so much of our legal system is geared toward finding who has the deep pockets. So anybody who has a business,
they have a target on their
they
back.
Have, yeah, they have a target on their back. And even though their negligence may be very minor in relation to
And what do you mean by negligence?
Thing,
so I'm sure you had to go to law school for 2 years on that.
Negligence is just the breach
mm-hmm.
of the standard of reasonable care. So, for example, a surgeon, he mm-hmm. cuts off the wrong leg.
Sure.
Okay.
Which happens.
Yeah. The standard is, well, was that a deviation from what you would expect from a reasonable, you know, surgeon in this situation? And if it's not, mm-hmm. he's negligent.
So you guys have had cases, I'm sure, on malpractice against surgeons that have done this. So what would be your main piece of advice? I have a piece of advice, but I want to hear from you guys on, when it comes to surgeons, how do you, what's the process that you guys think they need, they should have to make sure they don't make those kind of boneheaded mistakes? Because it happens.
Insurance is number one. I mean, they just need to be insurance. And interesting studies have shown that doctors who have good bedside manner are less likely to get sued.
So have charisma.
Yeah, just make the patient feel that they're the most important thing in the world and that you're attentive.
As they should be.
Yeah.
Okay.
People screw up. I mean, we're humans. Everybody's human. So a surgeon's going to screw up. A driver's going to screw up. Everybody's going to screw up. And that's where the insurance comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to screw up. You don't want to. The surgeon's going to cut off the wrong arm. It happens. So, I mean, yeah, have good bedside manner, less likely of getting sued.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's as egregious as the wrong arm mm-hmm. was cut off, then you're going to get sued.
Sure.
But just having that insurance there is really the key. And, you know, surgeons and all medical professionals are covered with that. So there should never be a problem as far as finding deep pockets go. But it's true, even if the surgeon screws up, the plaintiff's attorney doesn't just sue the surgeon. We sue the hospital. We mm-hmm. sue, you know, staff members who may be there, the surgeon independently, the company that the surgeon works for. There's so many different parties that are
And if
there.
The surgeon has good insurance, it still hurts their reputation, and then their insurance, malpractice insurance goes up, so their cost goes up, their reputation goes down. And one thing that they could have prevented with it is having a good bedside manner. One that I find helps a lot, I'm just a VFR pilot, but that it rammed down in my head, like checklists. For me, when I get, before I do my Cessna, even though I've done a pre-flight checklist over 100 times, I still write everything, every little thing, checking the fuel, all this stuff, because I'd rather have a problem happen on the ground than in the air. And they beat that into you, and I've learned that a lot of surgeons, when they just, the arrogance perhaps, that they've done it so many times that why would they need a checklist? But when you're in a rush or when you have other things on your mind, that's when the other arm gets cut off.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And just not going through that, like, hey, did we mark the area that we should cut in on these people? I don't know, surgeons, maybe that'll help you. It's definitely helped me not die in a plane, so.
Checklists are very valuable.
You know, I what I hear and what you're saying there is Yet there's a real need for a physician to meet professional standards, because that's how negligence will be measured, is it's a deviation from professional standards. So
got it. Some hospitals don't have that in process, though. Like, if you're a surgeon or a doctor and you're listening to this, you might be like, gosh, I wish that my hospital had like a standard checklist thing, or they do, but it's just in writing and nobody actually follows it, nobody enforces it. Because I've been reading stuff like that on hospitals that have made big mistakes like that all over the country, people cutting in the wrong side of people's skulls, all sorts of stuff. And a lot of it goes down to, like, you guys just didn't go through and check to make sure you're operating on the right person or right side of their head or all this stuff. So surgeons, that's good. That's definitely one that I see you guys going after a lot. What are some other most common cases that you see where who are the parties that you're suing?
A lot of car accidents, yeah, I would say.
The automobile is remarkable for generating liability in our society.
All right, this is a tough question, but how do I not get sued as a driver? It's like, don't make an accident, but...
Well, again, accidents happen. It's always going to be measured against a standard of reasonable care. So if you're going 55 miles per hour in a 25 mile per hour speed zone, that's probably going to be considered negligence. These are all jury decisions. I mean,
sure.
There's no black letter law that says if you're negligent or not. Exercise reasonable care in operating your vehicle. If you are in an accident, don't get out of your car and go to the other driver and say, oh, I'm so sorry.
Don't get out of your car and go to the other driver, really?
Yeah, because if you go to the other car and say to the driver, oh, I'm sorry, that could be considered an omission of liability.
Ooh.
So generally, the advice from lawyers to people who are involved in accidents, don't talk to the other driver. Provide the necessary insurance information. If you have a camera, take some photographs. Get witnesses' statements, or not statements, just contact information who have seen it.
What about the cameras that are so huge in Russia on the dash cams?
Those sure can be helpful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That has helped us win some cases, actually, having that. Showing what really did happen, the level of impact that there was. You know, everybody tells a story about how hard they were hit, or whether the person came out and nobody could see them. But those cameras sure do help tell the story. And I think for a jury to see that camera and see exactly how that accident happened, it just makes the jury feel more comfortable that, yeah, this plaintiff was injured. I see what happened. You know, I feel really bad for that person, and I think they need to be compensated for it.
So dash cam could help you prove that you weren't in the wrong if you're being sued, or
definitely,
if you were wrong and you know, hey, this guy pulled out in front of me and I deserve some monetary gain from this to help me with my situation because I just got my leg cut off. Luckily, they cut off the right one because the surgeon listened to this podcast.
Nice.
But a dash cam ends up coming into play as like, that was interesting. The other thing that you said, Philip, on staying in the car and not come out and say, that's a bummer because to me, I like to help. Like if I'm in that instance, that's a big value that you just gave me because I would like to come out and I'd probably just say, I'm sorry, just because I'm sorry that they're in an accident, even if it was their fault. Like, how can I help you? Anything like that. But yeah, stay in the car. And what if they're hurt though? At what point?
Well, I think you need to be human.
Yeah.
And if there's a fellow driver that's injured and you're a human, you should go and try to help that
person.
Right,
be a good Samaritan.
The most important thing is you don't want to go to the other driver and say, I'm sorry. Yeah. Or, I don't know how this happened.
You could go and help them.
Go help them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you okay?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Don't talk about the accident. Don't talk about, oh, I thought it was green for me, or I thought you were going to stop first, or I thought my brakes were working. Don't talk about the case.
Yeah.
Don't talk about how it happened.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm sorry this happened. You know, if you're going to say you're sorry at all, because some people just feel like they have to say that, just make it very clear about what they're sorry for. I'm sorry that this had happened. Not that I'm sorry it happened to you, or I'm sorry that I caused this, or I'm sorry that my brakes didn't work. Just, you know, hey, I'm sorry this had happened. But still have to be careful, because that could be construed as, I'm sorry I caused that accident.
Mm-hmm.
But do the human thing, help them out, call the ambulance. But getting all the evidence together initially, I think, is a great idea, as Phil said. You know, take the photographs, hey, if they make a statement, if they say something like, "Boy, I'm so sorry, I didn't see you coming," you know, take a note of that, because that's going to be useful when dealing with the lawsuit that comes out of it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting.
And something that commonly happens in automobile accidents is that the insurance companies involved will quickly try to contact the parties and get a statement. And that's a dangerous situation, because the insurance companies are well trained to extract information from people who have involved in accidents in a way to reduce their liability or need to pay. And my advice is that if you do find yourself in an accident and you are contacted by an insurance company, do not give a statement. Obtain a lawyer to represent you in that process.
So this has been fascinating. I've made a lot of mental notes on stuff I should do. Dash cam, take care of people if they're hurt, but don't talk about the accident whatsoever. What about insurance? Like, you know, I'm trying to save some money, but what do you guys find has been things that have burned people because they tried to save too much money and the insurance didn't cover what happened?
You know, we have an article on our website that talks about this, where I get it that you want to spend as little money as possible on insurance because you're not going to need it anyway, but I tell you, the day that you need it, that's the day you sure wish you had more insurance. And it's not just we're trying to have the minimum insurance available that's allowed in Oregon, $25,000.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's fine, but boy, if you hurt somebody and they have medical bills, and you know, $25,000 is not very much money nowadays when it comes to doctors.
No, you hit a BMW from like the early 2010s, and that's done.
Yeah, $25,000 gone. Yeah. But and then the lost wages that the person has suffered, the pain and suffering that they've gone through. You know, if they lost an arm or if they lost anything, all of that gets tacked on and goes, that person has a claim against the person who was driving that caused the accident, which in that value of that claim is going to be whatever it is, $100,000, $200,000, you know, who knows. And if you only have $25,000 to cover that, that means that that injured driver can come after you personally. So you personally now are on the hook. If you own a house, well, now you may not own a house anymore. You may lose your house. You may be forced into bankruptcy to get rid of the judgment. If you have a business, you know, income from that can be taken, garnish your wages, your paychecks, garnish your bank accounts. So you're just at so much risk by not having enough money to cover that. And that's only one part of it. Let's say that you were that driver with the $25,000 policy. You get into an accident. Maybe it wasn't your fault, but the driver on the other side didn't have insurance. I mean, that happens. There are people who drive without insurance. And if they don't have insurance, then your uninsured policy, because oftentimes you have different types of policies within your car insurance policy, if you don't have enough uninsured policy, there's not enough money there to cover your own medical bills or your own pain and suffering, your own loss of your car. So you're really hurting yourself by not having enough insurance. And I know people don't think about that. They think about, well, I'd rather pay as little as possible.
Yeah, say 15% or more.
Sure, right. But boy, your insurance company is going to be your best friend if you get hit and you need lawyers helping you and you need somebody to pay that claim out. You sure would feel bad. I've seen wrongful death cases where the person who caused the accident only had $25,000, and we have somebody who died because of that. I think as the driver, you will feel really bad, obviously, because you know you've caused this problem.
Of course.
But you also, I would think, feel very bad that you don't even have enough money to cover some of those expenses for that widow, you know, any of that stuff. So it just, it's really ugly not to be insured well enough. So
what about,
here's one thing about insurance is it's the first $100,000 of coverage that's the most expensive. And as you keep adding coverage layers to that, the price goes down dramatically. And it, to have $1 million of coverage, it's not out of question. And the price is substantially reduced. It's not a direct growth from the same.
Do you ever see $1 million needed?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
We've got a situation right now.
I think that's like overkill.
$25,000 Progressive policy, and he pulled out and hit a guy on a motorcycle. Husband and wife on the motorcycle. They have medical expenses over $1 million.
Okay.
And he owns property.
Okay.
So he's exposed.
So that property would be seized?
If the plaintiff proceeds in court and gets a judgment against the driver, mm-hmm. our client, and the judgment is in excess of the insurance coverage, which it would likely be, then the holder of that judgment can go levy against property, bank accounts, income streams, right. automobiles, airplanes, boats.
Other assets.
This seems a little grim, but I'm going to go there anyway. But what does it typically end up costing someone if you... Because it happens a lot more than people realize because it's so normal. But if you accidentally kill somebody... There's no medical expense then, but there is an expense.
Well, there's usually medical expenses. Oftentimes, you know, unless it's the ugly accident where somebody dies right there on the scene, mm-hmm. but there's usually ambulances that come, and they're pretty expensive. And then oftentimes they will hopefully take that injured person and try to, you know, make them survive.
Yeah.
And that can get very expensive.
Or they get air flighted out.
Yeah. All of that is so expensive. Mm-hmm. But what happens? Well, you just hope you have enough insurance to cover that. And
right.
then if you don't have enough insurance, you just hope you don't have any assets.
Mm-hmm. Generally, 96% of all cases filed in court are settled. Mm-hmm. And often they're settled at insurance limits, except in these extensive cases where there is a large excess judgment and the client has resources. But most of these claims are ultimately settled through the insurance companies.
Okay.
So just having that insurance is there to, mm-hmm. it's just there to help protect you, and it does generally protect you. And just being smart about how much insurance you have. And we talked about $1 million policy. I think my $1 million policy is like $400 a year. And so I've got, you know, decent coverage for my cars, mm-hmm. and with, you know, working with insurance agent, they'll help you figure out what is, you know, what you need and how to make that come together. But just having that extra insurance policy, that umbrella policy, has been very useful, I found, and even just plaintiffing and suing other people for different things. It's amazing what that insurance company, that umbrella policy will cover. It will cover things that you don't expect it will cover.
Hmm.
Like, and I'm just thinking about one of them that I had, where I had to sue a neighbor of somebody because of the dog barking or something going on. But there was so much money spent in attorney's fees fighting over this, that you'd think that would be enough to get the parties to like stop.
Mm-hmm.
But no, because one of the parties had an umbrella policy, and so that party had a free lawyer to defend that case and to deal with that case, pay a little bit of money out of it, you know, make the case go away.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some perks to having better insurance.
Sure.
Things that you wouldn't think were possible. One of them, like a defamation claim, where you sue somebody because they've said something that is wrong and it's harmed you financially, then I've seen umbrella policies cover that, cover the case, cover the lawyer, and cover the damages.
Okay.
And so having that umbrella policy, I think, is a really good idea. It's good for automobile insurance and the umbrella over it. If you own real estate, you know, having an umbrella policy over the top of everything, that's great.
Hmm.
And it just covers lots of different things that you don't expect it would.
Interesting.
Maybe it's not clear, but there's two duties that arise against an insurer under an insurance policy. Duty to pay claims,
mm-hmm.
you know, what the other side, how they were injured, replace their car, pay their medical expenses. But the other duty, and it's maybe the most important, they have a duty to defend you. So they're going to hire a lawyer, and that lawyer, they're going to pay that lawyer to handle your case until it either goes through trial or settled. And that, if it's a $25,000 policy and it goes to a case, attorney's fees could be $100,000. So, but that's not part of, that's not expressed as a policy limit.
Yeah, people don't think about that,
yeah,
right?
But that's,
I don't think about, when I'm computing, I think I have a $500,000 policy, which is now, after this talk, is going to go to $1 million, right when you guys go. I'm computing in my head, because I'm not a lawyer, I'm just like, okay, $500,000, that's pretty good. If somebody gets pretty hurt, I think that would cover it. Now I think differently. And what was going through my head is not how much to pay for both attorney's fees, right? Because you have to pay the other attorney if they win, so...
Not necessarily.
Or is that necessarily true? Okay.
Yeah.
In some cases, that is true, either by contract or by statute, that can be allowed. But in a typical negligence case, you don't have a claim for attorney's fees.
Okay.
So the plaintiff's attorney doesn't get their attorney's fees out of it.
They're working on a contingent basis.
Just to bring more value to the people listening, because this has been very insightful, I want to know what are the do's and don'ts if I'm in an accident? Let's start if I cause the accident. So you guys taught me that, you know, having the dash cam, not saying you're sorry, staying in the car if the person's not hurt. And then now the police show up. What would be some tips on what I should be doing when the police show up in an accident that I am at fault?
Well, I don't think it's your responsibility to determine that you're at fault.
Okay, and if I have a feeling that it was my fault.
You can have that feeling. Keep that feeling to yourself.
Right.
That's the police officer's job to figure out who's at fault,
mm-hmm.
or the insurance company's job, or the plaintiff's job. Mm-hmm. If you're at fault, and you have that suspicion that you're at fault, keep your mouth shut. Let mm-hmm. them figure it out.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if you're guilty.
Sure.
Don't say, yeah, I'm guilty.
Yeah.
Let the court prove that. Mm-hmm. Let it be proven.
Okay.
Good to know. You want to be a good person to do the right thing. But insurance and through the process of litigation, it will all come out. All the truth will come out. It mm-hmm. will be determined, you know, who's at fault. You don't need to offer that.
Sure.
Just leave it to yourself.
What if you are the person that got hit and the police officers are like, what I'm looking for is like, how do I make sure they're doing their job? Do you guys ever see in cases where the police officer forgot to do the drawing or to file this certain paperwork and that would have been completely done, but like the surgeon, they forgot to do the checklist and... I don't know, maybe that doesn't happen, but
generally pretty professional mm-hmm. police. I think maybe really the most important thing, and this has happened in another case where the two drivers say, let's not call the police, just give me your number and I'll give you the answers. You know, you want the police there to get that third party independent observation, write up an accident report, list the witnesses. That's going to be valuable later on.
Okay. Yeah, because that does happen when people just like exchange insurance numbers.
Right.
Even when in a fender bender, you think you'd want that?
The police?
Yeah.
I've got a fender bender right now, and you look at the cars, and it happened late on a Saturday night. Cars aren't very damaged, but my client's been in physical therapy 3 times a week for the last 6 weeks.
Oh.
So.
Whiplash?
It's what's known as soft tissue injury, and it's not, you don't break a bone, but something in your muscular system or skeletal system has been stressed,
mm-hmm.
And it leads to some long term debilitation.
Got it.
Very common thing is something called TMJ, tympanomodular modular joint, in the jaw. Common thing to show up in automobile accidents. That gets strained, the teeth don't mesh well, it causes pain, headaches.
I've been in some accidents. I wonder if that's
that's how that started. TMJ, so
yeah, it's loud as heck. I mean, that's annoying, but I can't open my mouth that wide. Okay, shifting back to business owners, like how does a restaurant, because I'm sure what I know is that 9 out of 10 restaurants their first year end up failing, and then the second year it's close to that number as well, the ones that did survive. And I'm sure there may have been cases brought against them when it came to having somebody drive home that were intoxicated and their insurance didn't cover it, and that could have been one of the reasons that I watched a restaurant board up. Others is obviously because inventory problems they had, they didn't get enough or whatever, staffing, there's all sorts of stuff. But as a restaurant owner, what should they be looking out for their for somebody to be driving home from their bar from a table that's had a few martinis or cocktails and they get in an accident? How are they going to make sure they're not going to go out of business?
Surveillance cameras are helpful.
Okay.
Training of your personnel, and that training is readily available in regards to service of alcohol.
So surveillance camera, is that helpful because then the jury could see that the person was not very intoxicated as they walked out?
That would be, I think, a defense attorney, if the surveillance film showed this, would argue to the jury, look at this person, see them get up, they walk to the door, there's no weaving, stumbling, mm-hmm. they're communicating with people as they're going out. There's nothing here to indicate that they're visibly intoxicated. Now, you got a problem if you've got an invoice that shows 12 martinis consumed over the last 2.5 hours.
Sure.
So it's... the evidence is mixed, but surveillance cameras help a lot.
Insurance.
Yeah.
You just have to have it. Mm-hmm. And you know, I would say any restaurant
too. And I'm sure this would just go into what we were just talking about, but as a restaurant owner, you'd be like, I need to save money. I'm getting my restaurant going, and I'll maybe a half a million. I'm not sure. I'm not a restaurant owner myself, but maybe that's where they want us to stay at, like I am. And but really, after hearing this podcast, maybe you know you should go to a million or 2 million.
The cost to increase your coverage, to put in a surveillance camera, to train your employees are negligible in regards to the potential liability that you can face. So
yeah,
that would be the incentive for a business owner to go out and do this.
Business owner would also be wise to take the advice of their insurance agent. Mm-hmm. Have an agent that works for them, and take their advice. You know, give them all the information, mm-hmm. so that agent who specializes in this can and knows this and has their own insurance to make sure that they're giving good advice, can tell you how much insurance you need and what type of policy you should have. So getting that advice is very important, because if let's say that there was some accident, some injury, and there wasn't enough insurance, it's very possible that business owner would have a claim against the insurance agent for not giving good advice or recommending this amount of insurance or this type of policy.
Interesting.
So it's a world of insurance. Mm-hmm. So getting that professional advice from people who are capable of giving that, mm-hmm. is very smart to do. Because not just because you get that advice, but because there's some money backing that advice as well. So if it was bad advice, there's some money backing it. Same thing with a lawyer. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have lots of insurance. So if we gave bad advice, somebody was injured because of our advice, then you know we're covered for that, for malpractice. Same as a surgeon, anybody else.
Okay. Property owners. The one thing that I know that is in the back of a bunch of property owners' minds is, what if a kid was just playing on my property and broke his leg because of a sprinkler head?
Right.
What do you think are some of the main ways as a property owner that they can make sure that this horrible situation doesn't happen to them?
You know, it comes down to being a reasonable person and spending 3 years in law school to figure out what that means.
Right.
But it's
okay, so we didn't spend three, we're property owners, and we didn't spend 3 years in law school.
But it's you'd think it'd be common sense, but I don't know if it's common anymore, so I'll just say it.
Yeah.
Pay attention to what's going on your property. Mm-hmm. Walk around your property. Look to see, are these sprinkler heads sticking up really far? Am I going to trip on this? Mm-hmm. If I'm going to trip on it, it's a good chance somebody else is going to trip on it. Or is there an attractive nuisance, a hole right in the middle of my yard that the kids want to come and play in, and it fills up with water and they splash around in it. Mm-hmm. If you see anything like that, just know that if anybody gets hurt, it's your responsibility. And so as that homeowner, you've got to be smart about it and think about it and say, well, should I put a cover over this hole? Mm-hmm. Should I, you know, fix the plumbing so that it's not sticking out in a dangerous situation? Or should I kick the kids off the property? Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the right thing to do, is get the kids off the property, get anybody off your property so that they are not a risk to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my dad had a property on top of Cinder Butte in Redmond. And it was our vacation house from, we grew up in Chicago, and so we'd fly out there. And 1 year, so we'd be gone. We'd be there 1 month every summer, so at least 11 months of it being pretty much unattended. Sometimes we'd go out there for Christmas. Some kids put up a zip line because it was on top of a butte, so you have the angle. And I found it, and man, it was fun. And then my dad found it, and I was like 12, and he instantly cut it down. And I was just like, oh, why? And that's why.
Because he was being a reasonable person. He was being smart about his property, mm-hmm. and making sure that nobody's going to be getting hurt on his property while he's there or not there.
Yeah, and so that'd be an interesting case. So what if, like, the kids, because he didn't set up the zip line, I didn't set up the zip line, some kids came and set it up, and what if they set it up and they went down and then the cable snapped and the kid goes tumbling down and breaks both his legs? Like, would that be something where my dad could have been sued easily for that?
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that bug you guys at all, that's how the law system works sometimes when it comes to that specific kind of example?
There's a lot of things that bug us about the law, but we also...
I mean, I know you guys didn't make the law.
but you know, we know what the law is there for, and especially in personal injury world, it's not there just to punish somebody who did the wrong thing. It's there to spread the wealth, mm-hmm. from people who've lost something, take it from people who have something. So there's a lot of...
It's a Robin Hood type thing? Well, I never thought of it like that.
But when you do have terms like deep pocket, I mean, it does imply that, and I mean, courts have used the term deep pocket in articulating how damages should be determined at times.
That's interesting. Never thought of it like that.
You look at I mean, it all comes down to the reasonableness or the fairness and all that. So you look at the zip line situation. Well, is it fair that we've got these I'm going to assume they're underage kids who set this up and they're having a good time, and the rich landowner, your father who owns this property,
sure,
wasn't making sure that there wasn't something silly going on that property, that there wasn't a fence up so that nobody could fall off that bluff or set up a zip line. So it's putting the responsibility into what the law would think would be the most responsible and capable person of keeping it safe. So that'd be the homeowner, as opposed to the kids who are underage and dumb and they're trying to have fun. So that's where, you know, if that kid gets hurt, kind of pushing the liability onto somebody who I would say that doesn't seem fair. But if you look at all of the different policies, shifting the burden to the party that can handle it the most, shifting the responsibility to the party with the deeper pockets, you feel bad for the kid that got injured, but they're also underage. They weren't real smart about what they were doing, and we expect that. The law expects that children aren't that smart, or they won't do the reasonable thing. You've got to be an adult to be reasonable, I guess.
Go ahead.
I don't think I have anything.
Okay.
I was thinking about, what about properties that you rent out then? Like, what if you have multiple properties around... How do you make sure that the tenants aren't doing something that's going to make you end up getting sued? Is just coming by and checking, or
it's a more complex area because you're in a commercial relationship with the tenants, and there's a greater duty on the landlord or owner to protect and care for your tenants. Again, the lease itself. If you look at a lease in Portland nowadays in terms of the exclusions that it has as to the activities that a tenant can engage in, it's pretty restricted. That's part of it. Now, that's no sure impediment to a tenant disregarding that, but at least you've taken the step as the landlord, seeing what's reasonable. Yeah, I did want to get back to the zip line thing with your dad. The situation changes dramatically in terms of liability if, one, he went on the property, saw the zip line, and didn't do anything about it, and then the kid has the accident. Or if the kid has the accident before your dad has been on the property and is even aware of the zip line. There's shifting.
There's difference, yeah.
Yeah.
He'll get sued.
He'll get sued because inherently, I mean, some lawyers file cases simply for nuisance value because the insurance company is going to have
for
to
what
pay
value? Sorry,
nuisance
value.
Value.
Okay, I haven't heard that.
Insurance company is going to have to pay, in a minimum, probably on a PI case, $15,000 to $20,000 to defend it. Will they give you that in settlement at the start of the case? Probably, rather than going through the case. So.
That's interesting.
Not always. I mean, insurance companies will definitely defend cases that they don't feel have merit as opposed to paying the nuisance value. But, you know, it does happen where they will just say, you know what, this is a little more complicated. We know it's going to be expensive to defend this case. Let's just put our attorney's fees towards, or what we know will be expected to get paid for attorney's fees, let's put it towards the settlement. Let's put it in the plaintiff's pocket. Everybody goes away. It's sometimes a lot more civil that way, less drawn out, less expensive. And the insurance company knows for sure what they're paying on the claim. So having that known dollar number is very useful for the insurance company.
So you guys have won almost like endless cases over the years. What do you think has been the main reason to your success?
It's all about telling a story and telling that story in a credible way.
That's how I do marketing.
It's the secret of life.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're just holding yourself out there honestly and you do what you say you're going to do, that's 90% of the game right there. So,
yeah. And I would say our success is that we care about everybody that comes into our door. We really do care about them. Bend over backward to help them in any way that we can. You know, or whatever resources we can use to help them, we'll do that. And so I think if you treat your clients, you know, with respect, and you honor what their wishes are, and you truthfully seek their goals and keep their goals as your goals too, then I think that's where a lot of our success has been. You know, people like us because we like them, and we really want to help them, and they can see it. They can see it in our faces. They can see it in our work.
This is sincerity.
Exactly.
It, yeah.
Right. We're not just trying to get in there and, you know, get some money, get out. No, we really want to help them. And sometimes their goal is, you know, let's settle this as quickly as we can. And that's fine. We'll do what we, you know, what we need to meet their goals. But that's always the thing. It's always reassessing, you know, where do they want to be? When they start a case, they may want $1 million. By the time that they're end, you know, done with it or close towards the end of it, they may say, boy, this is a lot of work. This is a lot of time that I put into this. I really just want to get out of the case, and I'd be happy with, you know, $100,000, not $1 million. So it, you always assess that and then just see where people are and then do our best to get that for them.
Who's your favorite type of client? Not as, I don't mean as like a auto accident case or a medical case, but more of like a personality type of case. Who do you guys like to deal with the most?
You know, this term reasonable person comes up
a lot. Hey, yeah.
And you get a sense of what's reasonable and what's not. The more
do you ever turn clients away?
Oh, yeah.
Fired them.
Sure. Yeah, why?
Not being reasonable.
Not being truthful, not supporting their case, not working with us.
So integrity, I'm hearing, is pretty big.
Very much, yeah.
And that's, you know, you look at the case, and let's say it's a, you know, good value case, and everything's going just fine, and then you find out your client lied about something or is telling some half-truths, that's going to show up in the jury, and the jury's going to recognize that, and now you're going to lose your case.
And so, then you guys probably then feel slighted. I know I would.
Sure.
I'm like, you lied to me.
Yep.
Yep.
You don't ever lie to your lawyer.
Yeah.
Don't lie to your lawyer or your doctor.
It's good to know.
We're here to help you. Yes.
Yeah. Well, taking things back to a little more of a funny note, what do you guys think has been the most hilarious, funny case, funniest case, court case you've ever seen?
I don't know. To me, by the time a plaintiff gets into the law firm and then they take those steps to hire a lawyer, they're pretty upset with what they're doing or what has happened to them. And so it's not so much a laughing matter for them. Mm-hmm. And we don't see it as a laughing matter either. We take it very seriously. So I can't say that I have any funny cases. I know Phil has dealt with some other cases in prior experiences that may be funny, but not me. I think they're all very serious. We try to have fun along the way if we can, a little levity if we can, but the truth is it's a serious situation. A lawsuit is a very serious situation.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, seldom has a court erupted in laughter that I've been in. I had a case that involved a Safeway employee who brought a lawsuit against another Safeway employee over offensive farting. That was a humorous topic, I mean, among the lawyers. But
I think that's funny. I'm not a lawyer, so I can laugh at that.
But it was serious enough for this employee to bring a legal claim. And it has to be treated accordingly.
Sure.
So.
Well, then take things on a more serious note now. I want to talk about, you know, you guys are the owners of your business. And I want to know, like, how do you view what's the importance or what kind of culture do you guys have at your office?
Well, law firms tend to be stressful because we're always dealing with clients who are in a stressful situation. They're always in their worst place, generally, and that's why they need a lawyer.
Sure. So that brings a bit of stress to the office.
Brings stress to the office.
How do you guys deal with that, then? Do you ever notice when some team members might have a little...
All of us have experienced
it. It's a large training curve. It's a special world that they have to deal in. And the more social they are, I think the better they are at handling the work within a law firm.
Yeah.
We've had employees that are not capable of it, and they've moved on.
Have you been able to deal with, like, this is something that a lot of business owners will be listening to this, and how do you guys deal with the employees that aren't capable of it, and they don't know how to, they won't resign, and you need to terminate them? How do you go about doing that, or how do you know that it's time, and then How do you pull that Band-Aid off?
You know, I have this gut feeling that something isn't working with this person, and then I can usually put it down in writing and figure out what that is.
Mm-hmm.
And if, to me, if, and this is probably not the right way to do it, but if that, that gut feeling grows to a point where I can't handle it anymore, then I know something's got to change here. And so, you know, we let that person go. And then, boy, you know you did the right thing when you just feel so good afterwards.
Right. That's how I feel. It's I call it basically 36 hours of hell. So I have like the first 18 hours of leading up to it, knowing I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Really sucks. And then doing it in an 18 hours, technically it's less than that, of just like, oh, that was really neat. And I hate doing it. It's a lot. I try to do everything I can before doing it. But sometimes, you know, it's just the only thing that, and you have to do it.
Yeah.
And so you take the Band-Aid off, and 36 hours is a much easier price to pay. Oftentimes it's more like 24 than you don't do anything about it, and it keeps on bringing down your company's culture, keeps on taking down the clients you're using, and it keeps on keeping you up at night because you're like, I got to do something about Sarah or whoever, got to do something about Bob, and it just keeps on going, and because you don't want to take that step. And I understand it because I've been there. I'm sure you guys may have too. You went like, oh, you got to go, time to axe them. But I find that if you're able to do it,
keep it in a 36-hour time frame where you know that's the pain. 36 hours of pain. It's a great idea.
That's helpful, yeah.
Yeah.
Also, you help them, I find.
You know, when you let somebody go, you're doing the best for everybody because they don't need to be there or want to be there. There's something that's causing them to not fit in quite right.
Yeah.
So you're relieving them of this problem of being in an environment that's really not fit for them.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, it's better for the business, too. One thing that I've found, which you might give it a try, is spend maybe an hour, maybe 2 hours in that person's desk after they're gone. Get a sense of what's going on. You will find so many mistakes, problems, things that need to be corrected.
So you go up and sit down in their desk? Okay.
That's what I do. I'll just sit down. I'll go through. You know, we got to clean up emails. We got to make sure everything's tied up. But I always find things that, wow, I can't believe this didn't get done. How did that not go through? Or, you know, what other mistakes have there been that have been hidden for so long. I remember a firm I worked at downtown where a person was fired, and you know, the boss was looking through things and found documents from years ago that never were filed or you know, done with, which needed to be done. And so you've just, be careful with that. You want to follow up and make sure. Just because you let them go doesn't mean that the problem's ended.
How about finding people and hiring? Like, what have been some things you guys have seen over years that works best?
Be very specific with what you are wanting. Be very specific with who you want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can be as specific as personality.
Not just get a warm body in there because we need someone.
No, just be very clear in your mind about what you want and say that to them, either in the advertisement or when you're interviewing with them. Make sure that they know exactly what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think you have a better chance of getting exactly what you want if you're very clear on what you want. So I think that would be my suggestion.
What book has made the biggest impact on your guys' life? Business, law, philosophy, whatever? There could be a few.
You know, there's a book called Profit First that I like. I don't know if that's the biggest.
I like it already.
It's
I like the name.
Business. It's about business and how to run a business in a profitable way. And it has to do with, you know, watch out for yourself, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, watch out for everybody, but you've got to pay yourself first. If you're not getting paid, then there's no business.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that book was very good. Otherwise, I don't know. You know, you go to law school and you read a lot of books.
Yeah, you do.
And it's all case law and opinions, and they're all useful for when you need them, but it's not something that really changes your you know, how you're going to practice law so much. I mean, knowing the law is important, but...
What about in life, though? Just the way you look at the world, perhaps?
Yeah.
It could be fiction, nonfiction, you're like, huh. Or a movie, or just an interesting like thing that just made you look at things through a different lens.
I find that our profession requires so much reading that once I became a lawyer, my recreational reading dropped off dramatically.
That's fair enough.
And I guess I'll just proceed in this way. Is the law is my avocation. It's how I make a living. I originally went and studied law because it was a philosophical approach. I thought law represented where a society or culture, where their philosophy actually, where the rubber met the road, mm-hmm. how they expressed their law.
And what so, philosophies did you connect with?
Well, and the persistent books on my nightstand over the last 30 mm-hmm. years have been the Diamond Sutra, Red Pine's translation, and the Tao Te Ching, translated by Guy Fee Fong. And I just, those books
give me
the underpinnings of how do I go about my day and live it in a meaningful and alive way, mm-hmm. and am able to treat people compassionately.
Diamond Sutra, and what was the second one?
Diamond Sutra, the translation by Red Pine, which okay. I think is incredibly good, and then the Tao Te Ching, Tao Te Ching, and the Jane English Guy Fu Fin is by far the best translation out there.
Plus, what good is it? What are they in a nutshell? Either one. What are some of the main pillars it stands on? That keeps on saying over and over again.
I think the thrust of both Taoism and Buddhism is don't let your mind be free and empty and clear. And, mm-hmm. and the concepts and thoughts that we bring to our mind and believe are real are really the primary causes of our suffering and problems.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I think Albert Einstein said reality is just a perspective, or reality is a perspective, or is an illusion. Reality is an illusion. It's just the most persistent one.
Yeah, it's well done. Mm-hmm. It's very well done.
Yeah. So while you're going through that, I guess that would help you kind of sniff out integrity and lack of that in a client.
I think so. I guess, I mean, I don't...
You'd be surprised how you end up diving into those kind of books and everything, how you all of a sudden you start looking at the world a different way of... the other thing I hear that when you say that is like, let your mind be free is what I hear a lot in the philosophies that I listen to, or the main one I do is Stoicism. Mm-hmm. And so in Stoicism, the basic over and over concept is you only have control of your mind. That's it. You don't have control of your body, literally, because like you get hit by a car.
Yeah,
you can be thrown into jail. You don't have control of the weather, obviously. You don't have control of other people, just the way it is. But you do have control of this. And so, like when you end up having a big outrage, when you end up getting angry about stuff, that's just you, because you perceived as what was happening to you as bad. So I have been learning a lot over like the past year of just being able to be like, this is only bad because I'm saying it is, and my mind is letting it go there, and to bring that back. But I have been meaning to get into like checking out Buddhism, because it keeps on popping up in other like literature as I'm reading.
I think all of these philosophical systems at some level they kind of end up at the same point.
Yeah.
And if you're astute, I mean, you'll see those similarities. Mm-hmm. So there is an expression in Zen, and I think this touches on what you just said. Anything that you perceive that's coming at you is coming from within you.
Absolutely is.
Yeah.
I love that. Anything perceived is coming at you is from within you.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
There's this... So, Thomas Jefferson... Not Thomas Jefferson. He was a Stoic too, but... Thomas Edison... He had his building burned down in the height of his career without fire insurance, and his son grabbed him and they went running out, and he's just like, Dad, look at the building's burning down and there's no saving it. And you would be completely show complete empathy for Edison if he fell to his knees and started crying, but he didn't. He just goes, meh, it was just a bunch of rubbish in there anyway. He just took it as a new way to look at inventions in his business, and he ended up just inventing the light bulb after it, so minor detail, and everything worked out fine. And so I used to have these fears of, okay, if we lose, if I lose this client and this and this is that, like, because, you know, we have like about 150 clients here, and so we occasionally, we have about a 95% retention rate, which is great, but that means that, you know, we get a cancellation that comes through like probably once a month, maybe once every 6 weeks. And I used to just be like, oh my God, that's the first one, and then a bunch of others are gonna fall, and I'm not gonna be able to make payroll, and then we're gonna have to sell the sign outside for scrap metal, and like the business is going under. Yeah. When really, and then I started realizing that this thing that's coming at, just like you said, I perceived it to be doing that, and so instead, I'm like, okay, what can I learn from this client, and how can we fix this process to make sure this doesn't happen again? And so now we've been getting better and better. Retention's going up and up more, and I don't go into these tailspins. And yeah, I'm definitely going to check out these books. I appreciate that. What would be advice to your guys' younger self? Like, let's see, Mike, how old are you?
39.
Okay, you're 39. You look like my age, so.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's 30. I'm 30. I'm maybe 32, so God, I'm getting old. And if you don't mind, Phil, I'm guessing, what, 50?
63.
Wow, okay. This is going to be really powerful for you. Imagine both of you guys, 39, 63. Advice to your younger self, you hear that all the time, but I'm going to phrase it this way. You're 63, you're 39. You know what you know right now. You have all this intel up here, and now you're 18. What would you do differently?
It's a tough one.
It's a lot, right? But yeah. Can you imagine if you had this much intelligence? For me, at 31, I'd be like, oh my God, the game would be so... I would be like here right now. Like, yeah. I would just kill it.
Yep.
Buy Apple.
Buy.
Yes. I don't know. In some ways, I think Mike and I both have this love-hate relationship with the legal profession. And sometimes we discuss whether or not it was a good decision to go to law school. And I guess what I would say, my advice to myself now is the practice of law is fine. It has been an engaging work that's constantly drawn me out of my comfort zone, which I think is valuable.
Mm-hmm.
I would tell myself, don't be as anxious, don't be as concerned about conflict, you know, accept that it's part of life and just move through it. So.
Yeah, that comes from your books.
Yeah. I think I'm in the same boat. It's mm-hmm. it's just relax. It will all take care of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Relax and enjoy the ride. I think that's it. Knowing what I know now, yeah, relax, Mike, you're 18. Relax and enjoy the ride. Don't be in a hurry to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do something, but don't be in a hurry to run off and do whatever you think you need to be doing. Just let it simmer for a while and have fun in the process.
Right. Be happy. Know that you can be happy right now.
Yeah.
In any state that you're in, there's so many business owners that could be listening to us or watching us that are just like, and they are successful, and they might have like a $5 million or $1 million, and things are going pretty well, and they're like, oh, I'll just be happy when I get to $10
million.
Yeah.
No, you won't. You're just going to be miserable with a nicer car.
Right.
Yeah. just make it happen right now. Be happy now.
Yeah.
Okay, so how do people find you guys?
Well, we are on the internet, clarkgriffin.com. We certainly have our phone number, 503-543-4800.
Mm-hmm.
And email is great as well. You can also swing by our office, come in, say hi. Our main office is in Scappoose, which is a small community.
Mm-hmm.
But we're right outside of Portland, actually 30 minutes from downtown Portland, and we have an office downtown as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we're pretty convenient, and we're always happy to work with you to find ways to meet. You know, we'll have phone conversations, we'll have email conversations, or we'll come out and meet with you.
Great. Well, that was fantastic, guys. Gave me a lot of value on what I'm going to be doing when it comes to driving. Getting that dash cab and staying in the car unless the person's hurt. Not saying I'm sorry at all, because that means I'm guilty.
Well, just be careful with it.
Yeah.
All right. Everything used against you.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Okay, appreciate
thank
it.
You. All right, thank you.
Thank you for watching Torkum Talk. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Please hit subscribe and or follow to be notified when we launch our next episode. Have a good one.